Welcome to this afternoon's colloquium. So before we get started, you might notice a recording setup down here. That's the library recording it for a podcast. So your questions might get recorded too, I'm guessing. Yes. So just if you want to be part of posterity, keep that in mind when you ask a question. So anyway, it gives me great pleasure today to introduce Harvey Richer. Harvey got his bachelor's at McGill and his PhD at Rochester and has been here for a number of years. And he's well known for his work on resolved stellar populations. And he's going to talk about some of that today, specifically about white dwarfs in one or two special globular clusters.
Thank you. I'm not going to show too many pretty pictures there, honestly, but here's one, and then I'm going to show you one more a little bit later. I'm going to show some dark and dirty pictures because Scott said that he wanted to show more data. I'm going to show you what the data really look like and how we actually process the data. So the plan for today is to talk about white dwarf stars, some aspects of their lives, some particularly interesting aspects of their lives, which highlight a number of very, very interesting physical regimes, both high density, low density, and I think there, no matter what your field is, I hope there's going to be something for you in this talk. Here's the collaborators. This is a large team that that works together, sometimes coherently, mostly incoherently. There's a group from UBC, and two of my students, I think, are both here in the room, and if they're not, we're going to find out why. Saul Davis and Andrus. Jay Anderson from Space Telescope is a data reduction guru, critical part of the team. Brad Hansen's our white dwarf theorist on the team. Aaron Dodder, who's going to be in this area, just won a seat of postdoc, is our main sequence theorist. And Jason, an ex-student of mine, is also involved in the project. Jared Herney does N-body calculations. Ivan King, for those that know the name, he does King models, that's the King. And so there's a wide range of expertise on this group. And sometimes, as I said, we actually work coherently. So here's the plan for what I want to talk about today. I want to give you a short history about white dwarfs. And for those that are not in astronomy, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what they are, some very basic ideas about white dwarf physics, why we need the Hubble Space Telescope to do the kind of observations that I'm going to be talking about. And again, for Scott, the data and the reductions, just to show you quickly what we do to this lovely Hubble data. And then in the second half of the talk, I want to talk about just a number of selected moments in the lives of white dwarfs, sort of the big important parts. And most of these are, in fact, new aspects of white dwarf cooling that have been, some have been predicted, some hadn't. And for the first time with the data that we have, we were able to isolate these particular aspects of their lives. So we're going to explore things from some ideas in stellar dynamics to neutrino physics to condensed matter physics and through to cosmology, and show you that these mundane little objects can provide information on all of these aspects. So let me begin by a short history of white dwarfs. How they came to be discovered, and what we know about them from some very, very simple arguments. So here's a lovely picture. I wish I could say that I took it, but I didn't. It's over the mountains in Turkey, part of the Orion constellation that you can see over here. And this is Sirius over here. It's not in Orion, but Sirius is the brightest star, apparently brightest star in the sky. So Sirius, of course, was known since antiquity, but in 1844, an interesting observation was made that as Sirius moved through space, as it orbits around the galaxy, it doesn't just go through space like this, but it actually wobbles as it goes through space. And the only way to easily understand that is that it has a companion, and you just can't see the companion. The companion is too dim to observe. So it's a binary system. It was known back from 1844 that it was a binary system, and it was also known that the companion must be very faint because there was no evidence of it. It just couldn't be seen. In 1862, Sirius and Sirius B, the companion, were actually photographed, and a big surprise was the result of that. Sirius B, the companion, turned out to be a blue star and not a red star. And this was a big surprise because faint stars, all faint stars at that time, were red. But Sirius B, the companion, turned out to be blue, and people thought at the time, well, this is a new type of star that has just been discovered. And the fact is, that's true. And it wasn't until the 1930s that the structure of Sirius B, the companion, was actually explained, and you have to wait until the 1930s because it turns out you need quantum mechanics to understand the structure of the companion to Sirius. So here's some observations, very simple observations that tell you a wealth of information about Sirius and its companion. So this is a Hubble Space Telescope recent image of Sirius and Sirius B, and just looking at this image and doing some very simple things, you can learn an enormous amount about the system. So again, the faint star is blue. This is Sirius B over here. It's blue, as you can see in this real color image. And so this must be a new type of star, at least that was the idea in the 1860s, because all faint stars were red, but this faint thing was blue, so what is it? As you can also see in this picture, sort of, A and B have similar colors. And that means, to a first approximation, they have the same temperature. And that temperature is around 10,000 degrees Kelvin. And you can also see that their luminosities are enormously different. And in fact, as the number is about a factor of 10 to the 4 difference in their luminosities. So because the temperature is the same, and because the luminosity goes as the fourth power of the temperature and the square of the radius, the radii of these two must differ by about a factor of 100. A and B, from an analysis of the wobble, the binary system, they have about the same mass. That's true within a factor of 2 or so, which is good astronomical accuracy. So what that means, because the mass is about the same, the densities must differ by a factor of 10 to the 6. And since Sirius is about roughly the density of water, as is the Sun, you can say that Sirius B must have a density of around 1 million grams per cubic centimeter. Incredibly dense object, and you can come to that conclusion with a very simple chain of argument like you see here. So here now is a diagram which I'm going to be spending an enormous amount of time talking about, so I ought to talk about it just to make sure that everyone understands. It's called the HR diagram, and I would like to say that it's the HR diagram. But unfortunately, it's not true. This is named after Hertzsprung and Russell, two turn of the previous century astronomers that developed this diagram. And it's a pretty simple plot. All it is, it's a plot of the luminosity of the star along the y-axis, luminosity increasing upward. So this is just the total energy output of the star versus the surface temperature of the star. And the temperatures are plotted backwards. So hot stars are over here, cool stars are over here, low luminosity objects are over here, and high luminosity objects are on are up here on the y-axis. And if you take stars and you put them into this diagram, they don't lie all over the place. They don't fill up the diagram randomly, but they are concentrated in three distinct regions. Most of the stars lie on a region that's called the main sequence, which you can see over here. A small fraction of the stars lie up on the region up over here, which is called the red giant branch. And a small fraction lie in the region over here, obviously occupied by Sirius B, which is where the white dwarfs are. So the white dwarfs are low luminosity, and they're hot. The red giants are high luminosity, but they're cool objects. So all of stellar evolution is contained in this diagram. So if you understand this diagram in detail, you understand virtually all aspects of stellar evolution. And here's a little evolutionary diagram. This is, of course, based on models, calculated models of what a star like the Sun does in a diagram like this, how the Sun evolves in a diagram like this. So it turns out that the main sequence, most of the stars lie along the main sequence, and the reason for that is that it's a very, very long phase of evolution. This is where the stars are converting hydrogen into helium in their core. It's exactly what the Sun is doing, and they spend a very long time doing that. And our Sun is going to spend 10 billion years or so converting hydrogen into helium in its core. By the time the core is used up its fuel of hydrogen, the star then evolves up what's called the giant branch into the red giant region over here. Helium begins to burn, and there's a phase of evolution here where basically you're burning helium in the core. So you're converting helium into carbon, carbon and oxygen in the core. The star goes up the red giant branch again, maybe becomes a red supergiant. Then it ejects its outer atmosphere in what's called the planetary nebula, and I'll show you some wonderful pictures of those in just a second. And it exposes the core of the star. And the core of the star is basically carbon and oxygen, and that ejects the outer atmosphere, and the star cools very quickly, the core cools very quickly, and it becomes what we know as a white dwarf. So a white dwarf star is the core of a star pretty much like the Sun, and what you're seeing is the carbon-oxygen core that went through these various phases of nuclear evolution. And so all the star has is its carbon-oxygen core. It has no nuclear fuel left. So all the star is doing is simply cooling and radiating away its stored thermal energy out into space. So that's what a white dwarf star is. It's rather dull and uninteresting. And basically, it's a rock in space, which was hot because it recently was at the center of the star, and it's just radiating energy out into space. But I'll show you, I hope, that it's not entirely an uninteresting object. Okay, let me spend just a couple of minutes talking about some basic physics about stars, just so we'll completely understand everything that there is to know about white dwarfs. So here's a few basic ideas about stars. First of all, for normal stars like the Sun, you can calculate very simply a dynamical time scale. And a dynamical time scale is simply how long does it take the star to free fall through its own radius. And if you do the calculation for the Sun, take the radius divided by the free fall velocity, it turns out to be about 40 minutes. So what this tells you is that stars like the Sun must be in exquisite hydrostatic equilibrium. Because if it isn't, if they aren't, then they're going to collapse or expand on a very short time scale. So here's the equation of hydrostatic equilibrium, which just basically balances the pressure and gravity in the star. And the pressure that goes into this expression in normal stars like the Sun is largely gas pressure. Sometimes, if the star is quite massive, it can be radiation pressure. It's a combination of the both, but in stars like the Sun, it's largely gas pressure. And in high-mass stars, it's largely radiation pressure, which supports the star against gravity. So, for example, the Sun has the radius that it does because the gravity and the pressure are in equilibrium, and the radius of the Sun is the radius at which these two forces are in equilibrium. In white dwarf stars, however, the pressure here is quite different. The pressure is, in fact, the pressure due to electrons, degenerate electrons. So what are degenerate electrons and how does this provide a pressure force? Well, the core of the white dwarf star is really very highly condensed. And it's so condensed that the uncertainty principle actually comes into play. And so what this means is that even at 0 degrees Kelvin, there is a zero point energy given by p squared over 2m, which is this quantity over here. Since pressure is energy density, you can derive from this expression quite simply an equation of state for a white dwarf. And it's that pressure is proportional to the density to the 5/3 power. And notice that this is very different than a perfect gas law. I mean, there's no temperature in here, for example. So it's just related to the density. With a bit more algebra, you can derive the famous mass radius relationship for white dwarf stars. This is just a bunch of constants, and you see that the mass is inversely proportional to the volume. And that's a very unintuitive relationship. What that means is that the more massive your white dwarf, the smaller it is. Completely unintuitive. If you put the numbers into here, you can see that for about one solar mass, the radius comes out to be about the size of the Earth. So that's what a white dwarf is. It's an object which is supported by electron degeneracy, and it has a radius, typically it's half a solar mass to a one solar mass, and it has a radius of about the size of the Earth. Okay, now this is going to be important. It's going to come up a number of times as we go along. you can write a simple expression for the heat content to the core as this expression over here. And the only thing of really importance to remember is that Ni, which comes in here, is the density of ions in the core, the number of ions per cubic per volume in the core. And the reason it's ions here is simply because the electrons cannot cool, because electrons are fully degenerate, so they have no energy states to drop down into. But the ions are non-degenerate, and they can cool. And it's this, which it's the cooling ions, which supply the energy that we see, the thermal energy which comes out of the white dwarfs. So we can then multiply this by the mass of the core, multiply it by dt by d temperature by d time, and this gives us a luminosity, how much thermal energy from the ions, how quickly the ions are cooling, and that gives us the thermal energy of the luminosity of the core, how much thermal energy are we getting out of the ions. And again, with a bit of arithmetic, you can then show that the temperature goes as this power of time, or the luminosity of the white dwarf goes as this power of time. In other words, as time goes on, the temperature decreases, which is what you'd expect because you're losing thermal energy, or the luminosity decreases as this power of the time. So what this means, the fact that you can derive relationships of this sort, means that the white dwarfs cool with time, and if you can read the clock, then you can determine what the age of the white dwarf is. So this is basic ideas of white dwarf physics. So this is what a diagram of cooling white dwarfs look like, again, in this HR diagram. So again, this is just slightly different units, but it's the same diagram. This is just luminosities of the stars, high luminosity here, low luminosity here, hot stars here, cool stars down over here. And these are cooling curves for white dwarfs of different mass. So the reason that the low mass ones sit above the high mass ones, remember, is these ones are bigger than these ones down over here from the mass radius relationship. So it's a bigger surface area from which to radiate. So for example, if I know that a white dwarf is, let's say, 0.6 solar mass, which is this cooling curve, and I measure its energy output, this number over here, then I can go to this model derivation of the age here, and I can determine what the age is. So for example, a white dwarf of 0.6 solar mass that has this luminosity is about 2 gigayears old. Okay? So in this way, I can use white dwarfs as clocks, and I'm going to do that right at the end of the talk to derive an interesting age. Okay, let me stop talking about white dwarfs directly and talk about globular star clusters, because the observations which I'm going to be talking about involve these objects over here, which are called globular star clusters. So here's an edge-on view of a galaxy that's thought to be rather similar to our own galaxy. Here's the bulge of the galaxy, the center of the galaxy. This is the disk of the galaxy. It's seen edge-on, of course. If it was tilted in this direction, it would look like a pretty spiral galaxy. But this one is viewed edge-on. And an artist has painted in a bunch of dots around here. These are what are called the globular clusters. And these are large, rich clusters of stars that surround the nuclei of most galaxies. The sun is located somewhere over here, about two-thirds of the way out in the disk of the galaxy. So there's something around 200 of these in our galaxy. This is about the number known, but there's probably some number that are not yet discovered. These clusters typically have more than 100,000 stars in them, probably up to a million stars in some cases, so that means that there may be many white dwarfs in these clusters. These are tremendous things to study because all the stars are at the same distance, so you don't have to worry about distance effect, and that's a great boon because distances are really hard to determine for astrophysical sources. These clusters are typically very low in heavy elements, and that means almost certainly that they're old, although they're not a first-generation star because they do have some heavy metals in them, so there must have been some generation of supernovae or something like that that polluted the gas out of which they were formed. And one thing which is going to be of interest later, if I take a look, if we're here at the sun looking at some nearby globular cluster over here, you can see that the line of sight is going to pass, of course, through the disk of the galaxy because the sun is sitting in the disk of the galaxy. So when I look at a cluster, I'm going to have some contamination from stars in the disk of our galaxy. I'm going to have some contamination from stars in the bulge and in the halo of our galaxy. There's not just globular clusters in the halo of our galaxy. There's a small low density of stars. And I'm going to have some contamination from distant galaxies out beyond. And we'll see in a few moments that this is an important issue. So the observations which I'm going to talk about are looking for white dwarfs inside one of these kinds of clusters, one of these globular clusters. And you can see, for example, you can see the density distribution in the white dwarf here. And you can see that when you get out far, that the density more or less becomes constant. And this is foreground, background stuff. And that's exactly what I'm trying to demonstrate here. Okay, so if I want to observe white dwarfs in one of these clusters, which is what I'm going to do, I have some observational considerations. We know that white dwarfs are very faint objects, and these clusters have lots of stars in them, so there's lots of scattered light, it's very crowded, so I have to think of a way to observe these things that I can actually separate the kind of different kinds of stars from each other. So you need a superb imaging telescope. You have to be able to distinguish stars from faint, almost unresolved galaxies. So you need tremendous resolution. You have to be able to distinguish cluster stars from stars that are not in the cluster. And that's, of course, the hardest thing because they're both point sources. You can't use image morphology to do this for you. And I'll show you how we do that. So the best telescope in the world for that, of course, at least currently, is the Hubble Space Telescope. And here's a picture of the Hubble Space Telescope. Here are its important characteristics. It's a modest reflector. There are much bigger telescopes on the surface of the Earth. It went up to 10 meters. It was launched in 1990. It spent the first 5 years needing badly a pair of glasses, but they were eventually inserted. And the telescope has worked brilliantly since around 1995. It orbits at just under 600 kilometers above the Earth. Takes about around an hour and a half, and it has spectral sensitivity from the ultraviolet out to the infrared. So here's a few reasons why you want to do this work, or you want to do any work of this sort with the Hubble Space Telescope. This is what's called the point spread function, which is just what a star, which is an unresolved point source, looks like when you pass it through your telescope, your atmosphere, if you're at the surface of the Earth, the telescope, your filters, your detector, everything. So this is a typical point spread function. This is the same star, by the way. This is a point spread function which you might get from the surface of the Earth. And this is the point spread function which you get from the Hubble Space Telescope. So you can imagine how much better you can do in many aspects of your work working with a point spread function that looks like this. It's very spiky. And it helps to find faint objects because they poke above the noise more often than some blobby little thing like this will. We can measure positions much better with this, and we'll see that's important. And it also helps us to distinguish stars from almost unresolved galaxies. So this is one of the good reasons why you want to use Hubble. Here's another reason why you want to use Hubble. This is an infrared camera on Space Telescope, and these are images of the same field taken over a 9-month period. And if you look at this carefully, you can see that the point spread function is incredibly stable from all across this 9-month period. And this is another great advantage. By the way, the little circles around the stars are the first area disk. This is in the infrared, and you're actually seeing diffraction here. So tremendous stability in the point spread function, which really helps in the observations. So here's what we did in 2005. We submitted this proposal and we won the lottery as far as I'm concerned because getting time on Hubble really is a lottery. We got 126 orbits to observe a single field in a globular, in the nearby globular star cluster to go as faint as we possibly could. As one of our collaborators said, we're going to find the moons around the white dwarfs in this globular cluster. Not quite true, but close. So we looked at this globular cluster. It's one of the closest to us. It's 8,400 light years away from us in the direction of the galactic center. We had 4.7 days, not contiguous, spread out over a month, but that was 4% of all the time that was available on Hubble in 2005. If you want to put a price tag on this, it's about $25 million, and I don't think my grant covered quite all of it. The three sigma detection, this number probably doesn't mean a lot, but I worked it out this morning and I thought it would be cute to show. 4 × 10⁻²³ of the brightness of the sun. It's about a candle sitting on the moon. That's about the faintest objects that we were able to detect. And one of the nice things is that there is archival data in this field that we observed in the cluster that goes back 10 years.
Same resolution, Harvey?
Say again?
At the same resolution? This is archival data?
Not quite. I'll show you that in just a second. So this is the field on the sky. The cluster center sits out over here. We were out over here about 5 or 6 arc minutes away from the center. You don't want to be on the center because it's very crowded, a lot of scattered light, and you can't measure faint objects in the center of one of these clusters. This is the footprint of the camera that we used, this rectangular thing, and you can see that underneath it, there's a large number of footprints that look like this, and these are the archival data that go back 10 years. This is a somewhat poorer resolution camera than the one we used. This is a factor of about 2 worse resolution. This camera has subsequently failed, and it's hoped that in the new servicing mission in August that the camera will be resurrected. The archival data is, in fact, very important. Here's the only pretty picture I'm going to show. This is a combined image of our field. It's only about 20% of our field. But I put it up because even though it's a pretty picture, it shows incredible resolution with Hubble. You're sitting in the middle of one of these globular star clusters. The center of the cluster's down over here. And you can resolve nice background galaxies right through the cluster. So it's really, the data are absolutely stunning. OK, Scott, you can go after the next couple of slides, OK? OK, so this is how we do two things. I want to show you two things here. How we find stars and how we measure them. So this is a single image, and it's pretty awful. This is a CCD image of part of our field, and you can see they're pretty ugly looking things. There certainly are some stars in them, but they're full of cosmic rays. The CCDs in space are excellent cosmic ray detectors, not exactly what we want. This is a stacked image. This has 252 near-infrared images, and this is the same field, and this is all of them stacked together. And this star over here, which is going to appear prominently in the next few slides, is one of the faintest cluster white dwarfs that we were able to detect with these images. And you can see that it's not at all detectable on a single image. Okay, so how do we find stars in these clusters? So what we did was to develop a new way to find, actually, and to measure the stars. So we ended up making what's called a peak map, and Andres, who's somewhere here, actually worked on some of this a couple of years ago. So the idea about finding stars is the following. The images are undersampled, not terribly undersampled, but they are undersampled. So what that means is a large amount of the flux from a star is in the single central pixel, which actually helps a lot for finding, not so good for measuring. So what we did was we defined a local maximum as any pixel that was higher than its 8 surrounding neighbors. So we examined every pixel in all 252 of our images, and there's 4,000 by 4,000 pixels in each image, and we made what's called a peak map, which said that if this pixel was the highest pixel in the surrounding 8 pixels, we put a 1 into that position on the peak map, and if it wasn't, we put a 0. And then we did this for every pixel in every frame. And you can see, of course, there's going to be some background noise in this, but it's a very democratic way of finding objects. And so what we ended up doing was we looked for 3 sigma fluctuations in this peak map, which looks like this over here. And I say it's a democratic finding technique because, for example, a big, huge cosmic ray will put a one position on one frame, but it's not going to be there for the other 251 frames. Whereas a very faint star, which once in a while, in a statistically significant number of images, can poke above the noise, will be there some number of times that we can actually measure. And if a star can't poke above the noise in a statistically significant number of images, we're just not going to detect it. And that's all there is to it. So this is how we ended up finding the stars. And this is very important, because what this means is we want to be able to find stars in a way which we can then use for Monte Carloing, because we actually have to put large number of false stars into our images to finding out what our finding frequency is and so on. And we have to have an automated technique like this to actually find stars. So this worked really very nicely, actually amazingly well. So here's how we measured. This is actually how we measured the stars and measured the brightnesses of the star, measured the flux from the stars. What we have to do this is a very good model point spread function. And what I mean by a very good model point spread function, it just tells us the fraction of the star's light at each pixel, which is some delta x and some delta y away from the center. And this point spread function varies all over the frame. So it's not we have one point spread function. The point spread function is different at every position on the frame, so we have to model that. And then we can write that the flux in each pixel is this number here times this number here, which is the fraction of the light in that pixel for the at the ij's position in the nth frame, plus the sky value. So what this means then is that for 9 pixels times 252 images, every one of those 2,300 points is telling us what the total flux is from the star. So you can see that this is just an equation of a straight line, and the star's flux is slope f, and this is what this looks like for a bright star and a faint star. So the brightness of the star is simply the slope of the line. And this worked out tremendously well because we actually used 2,300 pixels or so to tell us what the brightness of every star was, and it makes for very accurate photometry. So that's how we measured the stars. So this is the result of all of that. So this again is one of these HR diagrams, brightness against temperature. This is what didn't show up particularly well. These are faint stars. Okay, this is when we used all the peaks. The data, the dots are a little small here, they're not showing up. This is when we rejected objects that looked as though galaxies. This is what the HR diagram of the cluster looked like. So here's the main sequence all the way down here, and here's an incredible white dwarf cooling sequence which we're going to analyze. And the thing about all of these stars here is that this is not bad measurement. These are these foreground and background stars that I was telling you about early that complicate our ability to get a clean diagram like this. However, we have a magic routine to get rid of foreground and background stars. And the magic routine is that globular star clusters are actually moving very rapidly through space, much faster than stars in the disk of the galaxy. Well, I mean, they're not moving at all. The globular clusters are in pretty much a non-rotating frame around the center of the galaxy, but the disk is whipping around at very high speeds, a couple of hundred kilometers per second. So the difference in that is what we can measure. So over time, and this I want to stress is highly exaggerated, over time, the globular cluster moves through space. And so we can look at stars which are moving with the cluster and those which are not moving with the cluster and separate them by this motion, which is called proper motion. It really is only about 10 milliarc seconds per year. It's an angular measurement across the sky of about 10 milliarc seconds per year. But that's large enough, we can easily measure that. And this is what that looks like. So this again is brightness of stars. Faint stars are down at the bottom. And this is the motion over a 10-year period with respect to the cluster. So these are the cluster stars over here, and you can see that there's a big group of stars out over here, which are not moving with the cluster. They're moving at quite a different rate with respect to the cluster. This is zero-pointed on the cluster. And if you take a look at just what the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram is of the stars just in the cluster, you go from a diagram that looks like this to a diagram that looks like this, where basically all the foreground and background stars have been eliminated. And we use this proper motion, the high motion of the cluster, to be able to eliminate all these foreground and background stars. So that's a tremendous bit. Okay, so let me now talk about what we can do with these data. So I want to talk just about four or five selected moments in the lives of white dwarfs. I want to talk a little bit about what happens at birth and show you that white dwarfs really do get their kicks. I want to talk a little bit about neutrino cooling in white dwarfs. We can actually test electroweak theory using white dwarfs, although the tests are still a little bit on the weak side. We can talk about crystallization in white dwarfs. We'll see that white dwarfs actually crystallize in their cores, and they're basically big diamonds in the sky. White dwarfs in the CIA, they don't get into trouble. Something that Irving taught me, this is collision-induced absorption. For the first time, we actually see the effects of collision-induced absorption in our white dwarf cooling curve, and something that's dear and dear to Mark and Douglas's heart, you can actually learn a little bit about cosmology by looking at the ages of white dwarfs. Okay, let me step back for a second and talk about neutron stars. Neutron stars are born in supernova explosions. Supernova explosions are pretty violent events. It's thought that the explosion in a supernova can often be off-centered, and if you have that, you can have a rocket effect that can drive the resulting neutron star to very high velocity. Here's the velocity distribution of a group of pulsars, which are rapidly spinning neutron stars, and you can see that they peak around 100 kilometers per second. The precursors of these very massive stars have velocities of 10 or 20 kilometers per second. So here is definitive evidence that neutron stars get a big kick at birth, perhaps up to 100 kilometers per second as an average. This is the granddaddy of all of these. This particular pulsar has a velocity of 1,100 kilometers per second, which is about twice the escape velocity of the Milky Way. And this is the part of the sky that it's gone over in the 2.5 million years since this particular pulsar was born. So neutron star bursts are not quiescent at all. White dwarfs, when they're born, are also not necessarily quiescent. These are three examples of the gas which is thrown off from a star when it's finished its nuclear evolution before it becomes a white dwarf. This is the outer atmosphere of the star, which is slowly expanding outward. And here you can see the white dwarf, which has just recently formed in the star. And there's a fair amount of gas which gets thrown out of the star. Some of the mass loss is not always symmetric. Sometimes we see these bipolar flows. And so if the mass loss isn't symmetric, it can provide a kick to the white dwarf of this sort. And this is something that Saul has done as part of his thesis. This probably happens way up over here when the star is just getting rid of its outer atmosphere and becoming a white dwarf. The idea behind this is the following. When in a globular cluster of this sort, the cluster is able to separate stars out by their mass. So the high mass stars seem to the core of the cluster, just mass segregation. The high mass stars seem to the core of the cluster, and the lower mass stars get moved farther out from the center of the cluster. So what you would expect is that half a solar mass stars, which is what white dwarfs are, should look like half solar mass stars on the main sequence in their radial distribution in the cluster, because they have the same mass. Neither one is mass segregated with respect to the other one. So this plot over here, the dark line, is in fact the mass distribution, the radial distribution of old white dwarfs, and it's almost identical to half solar mass stars on the main sequence. Here's the radial distribution of young white dwarfs, which are less than a relaxation time in the cluster. They're 800 million years or younger, which is less than the time it takes the cluster to relax, to sort out the stars by mass. And although the slide doesn't come out terribly well, the remarkable thing is that the young white dwarfs are much more radially extended than the old white dwarfs, even though they have the same mass. And the only way to understand that is that these white dwarfs are kicked, have a small velocity kick at birth, 3 to 5 kilometers per second. They puff up. That's what we're seeing over here. And over a relaxation time, they relax to a distribution which is appropriate to their mass. So this is something which we were able to discover in this cluster, that it appears that the white dwarfs get kicked when they're born, and the kick's about 3 to 5 kilometers per second. And this was pure serendipity. We had no idea about this before we got the data, but Saul did some very nice detective work, sorted it all out, and made the discovery. Okay. Stars are great producers of neutrinos. So one can actually do a bit of neutrino physics by looking and analyzing stars, particularly white dwarfs, in some detail. Now, there's only two stars that we have actually directly detected the neutrinos from. They've been detected from the Sun in various neutrino experiments, and supernova 1987A, I think a handful of neutrinos were detected from that object. But you can actually produce neutrinos in the interiors of very hot white dwarfs. And the mechanism for neutrino production is what's called the plasmon neutrino process, which is basically a photon decaying into a neutrino-antineutrino pair. And of course, this is forbidden in a free photon, but the photon in the dense interior of a white dwarf, it can couple to the plasma, and this reaction can actually go. So, this is an important test of weak interaction theory, and we can actually measure the plasma neutrino process or its effect indirectly in white dwarf stars. And the idea is simply the following. Here's, again, this doesn't come out too well. Here are some models I don't know if you can see this well. This is the log of the neutrino luminosity divided by the photon luminosity for white dwarf stars. And you can see, for example, for our 0.6 solar mass white dwarf, that when the white dwarf is hot, say 50 to 30,000 range, the neutrino luminosity actually exceeds the photon luminosity by factors of several. So it's actually dominated by neutrino losses as opposed to photon losses. This star over here, one star in our cluster that we found, here's the white dwarf cooling sequence. One star that we found actually is a star in which the neutrino luminosity exceeds the photon luminosity, at least according to the models. We haven't, of course, detected neutrinos from this. We can do some very crude things, and this is very crude indeed. The neutrino fraction, the fraction of neutrino luminosity drops to 10%, below 10% after about 3 × 10⁷ years, which is till by the time the white dwarf cools to 25,000 degrees Kelvin. There's one such star in our field, so we can, in a very hand-waving way, we can say the birth rate then of white dwarfs in our field is about the inverse of this, about 3 × 10⁻⁸ per year. Remarkably, this agrees more or less with the rate at which stars are becoming white dwarfs if we look at stars peeling off from the main sequence that have completed their nuclear evolution. So this is potentially interesting, but it's not very interesting because we have crummy statistics and it's very hard to get any real data out of that. What's more interesting potentially is to look at how fast the white dwarfs are actually cooling. So here is a plot of a cooling of a white dwarf with and without neutrinos in them, for example. And you can see that the rate of cooling if with neutrinos is way faster than the rate of cooling without neutrinos. If you work out the numbers here, you can show that at about 30,000 degrees Kelvin, because of the presence of neutrino cooling, the white dwarf is dropping at a temperature of 10 to the minus 3 K per year due to neutrino cooling. That is a very small number, and we're never going to measure that number. So that's not going to work. But what does work is some of the white dwarfs are in fact variable. These are G-mode oscillations, gravity mode oscillations, and the periods depend upon what the temperature is. So here is again a plot from Winget's group. This shows you what the period changes in variable white dwarfs are, and you can see for something which is around 30,000 degrees Kelvin, the change in the period of a white dwarf is around 10 to the minus 13 seconds per second. And this number is easily measurable, well, not easily measurable, could be measured. In fact, as there is a claim in the literature that of at least one star that has a change in the period derivative of about this amount. So this is a test which is potential. It hasn't been done very well yet, but this is something that which we can potentially look at in the future if we find enough of these objects. And I'll pass it. Okay, take a look at this diagram of the white dwarf cooling sequence. You can see that the number of stars is slowly building. These are young ones, of course, here. They get older and older and older as we go down the sequence. But by the time we get to this point over here, you can see that there's really a tremendous increase, and then all of a sudden there's a tremendous increase in the number of white dwarfs at around this position. This corresponds to a temperature, the white dwarf, around 5,000 degrees Kelvin. And this is just about where the theoreticians say that the white dwarf largely crystallizes in its interior. So what's happening here is the white dwarf is cooling. Around here, the white dwarf crystallizes, and a large amount of heat is released due to latent heat crystallization, and that slows down the cooling, and you get a big increase in the number of white dwarfs. And it's exactly what we see at about this position. And again, this is the first time that this was actually seen in a cluster like this. Not one of the stars in here, but a field star. People like Jamie have done seismology. Jamie have one of the field white dwarfs, and that they thought just of crystallized. And what they found out that about 90% of the star had actually crystallized. You can tell that from the acoustic waves that travel through the star. And it's thought that you get a lattice in a carbon oxygen lattice to produce this crystallization. This star has a particular name. That's the name that's been given to it. Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds is given to this star, which showed a huge extent of crystallization. But here we're seeing the effect of basically a condensed matter bit of physics where the star begins to crystallize, and we see it in a slowdown in cooling and a big increase in the number of white dwarfs as we go down the cooling sequence. One of the really strange things that we saw in this cooling sequence was the following. As you come down the cooling sequence, you can see that all of a sudden, when we get to quite cool temperatures, instead of continuing to get cooler, the white dwarfs have all of a sudden turned around and started getting cooler. This is completely weird. Remember, what's happening is the white dwarfs are just getting cooler and cooler and cooler. Hence, they should be getting redder and redder and redder, and yet they're not. What happens is they turn around and they get bluer. What's happening here? Well, this was predicted more than a decade ago by Brad Hansen, who's been the theoretician, but the physical effect has been known for 40 years. We have an expert in our department. Irving is an expert in this. Herb Rush did work in this. And this is a thing called collision-induced absorption. And the physics behind this, this didn't come out at all very well. Maybe I'll kill the lights. Jan? Okay, I don't know if you can see that. Doesn't help much. Okay, well, we'll leave it at that so you can sleep more easily if you're so inclined. The idea is the following. The atmosphere of a white dwarf is high pressure, and it's relatively cool by the time we get down here. It's around 4,000 degrees K. which is cool for white dwarf atmospheres. What you can actually do with these kind of temperatures is to form molecular hydrogen. Remarkably enough, in a white dwarf high pressure atmosphere, you can form molecular hydrogen. Now, molecular hydrogen is a symmetric molecule, so it can't absorb radiation by dipole radiation, so it only absorbs by quadrupole and higher radiation, so it's a very weak absorber of radiation. But you can actually induce a dipole into, this is what this is all about, if two hydrogen atoms, hydrogen molecules come close to each other, you can actually induce a dipole in one of them. And then it's much more favorable for absorption. And the picture here is, if you induce a dipole, an incoming photon can be absorbed. Now, the spectrum of radiation of collision-induced absorption is, this doesn't show up very well at all. There is meant to be a black body curve here, which is around 4,000 degrees Kelvin, which looks something like this. This is if you have an atmosphere of pure hydrogen, and this is what the spectrum looks like if you have an atmosphere of helium, which makes it more dense, and hydrogen together. So you can see what happens. Again, here's where the black body curve would look like. You're getting rid of all the infrared part of the spectrum. So a lot of the infrared light from a white dwarf star, which suffers from collision-induced absorption, is removed, and those photons are basically eventually upscattered, and they appear in the blue part of the spectrum. So that's what causes the white dwarf cooling sequence to turn around to the blue. And again, this is something that had never been seen before, although it had been predicted for more than a decade, and the whole physics was known for 40 or 50 years. So this is what theory told us should happen. This is a white dwarf cooling sequence with hydrogen, with a collision-induced absorption in a hydrogen-rich atmosphere. And this is one if there was no hydrogen, so the white dwarf would just continue to cool. This is what you'd expect to see with collision-induced absorption. And here's what we saw in the data, which was a stunning confirmation, although it's not perfect. Let me leave that for now. Okay, the last little bit I want to show you involves ages of white dwarfs. So again, here's the cooling sequence. Here's the effect of collision-induced absorption. So think of what's going on here. We have neutrino cooling here. We have crystallization going on here causing this bump. We have collision-induced absorption going over here causing it to be blue. And you can see that there appears to be a truncation in the white dwarf cooling sequence down at the end over here. And I want to stress that it's going to be an important age diagnostic because this is the limit to which white dwarfs can cool given the age of the cluster. So it's really going to be a very important age diagnostic. And this little diagram just shows you it's not due to the effect that these stars were so faint that we couldn't find them anymore. This is basically number versus brightness. Faint stars are over here for the white dwarfs. And this is number versus brightness for unresolved objects. And you can see that we certainly found unresolved objects a lot fainter than the white dwarfs. So this truncation here is not due to incompleteness in our data, but it's due to a real effect that there's just not very many white dwarfs down over here. We can't say exactly how many because we couldn't proper motion clean all of this work down over here. But we can use this to determine the age of the cluster. And this is the last thing that I want to mention. What we've done to determine the age of the cluster is just we model the white dwarf cooling sequence. So we put a bunch of boxes over it, and we just count the number of stars in each one of these boxes. And then we make a model, which is how many white dwarfs we ought to see in each one of these little boxes. And there's a lot of stuff that goes into the model, and here's a whole bunch of it. I won't go through it all, but there's a lot of details that go into the modeling. And of course, the white dwarf cooling models are an important part of this. So this is what it looks like. Oh, you can't see the models. Oh, terrible. Okay, well, trust me. These are the data. What's plotted here is just the number of stars in each one of these boxes and color along over here. And this is in various magnitude ranges. So these are the data. And there's error bars here. And there is a model underneath it, which you can't see, which agrees very well with the data. Trust me, it agrees well with the data. So this depends upon the age of the cluster. And when we do the best fit, this is our best fit model, and the model is under here. Again, trust me, it is there. This gives us an age for this for this particular globular cluster of about 11.5 gigayears. We get a really good chi square. And although you can't see it here, the data at the faint end is, there's too many blue-white dwarfs compared to the model, and I'll mention that in just a second. This error does not include errors involving different white dwarf cooling models. This shows what I was trying to tell you up over here. Here's our white dwarf cooling sequence. Here's exactly the same data, just not so bright points. And here's our best fitting white dwarf cooling model, which is a very good fit, but you can see that the data get a little bit bluer than the model. And here is a realization of this model putting in our photometric errors. So you would hope that this looks exactly like this. And you can see that it doesn't. What's happening is the white dwarfs have turned a little bit bluer than our best model is. And this is actually turned out to be very, very interesting, because a bunch of theoreticians at Los Alamos looked at this and said, well, we know what the answer is. And it comes about from this diagram over here. These are all stars of about 10,000 degrees Kelvin. These are spectra of stars at around 10,000 degrees Kelvin. These are they're basically just Balmer lines. This is H beta, H gamma, H delta, and so on. This is a very high luminosity star, and the luminosity is decreasing as you go down the sequence here. So these are stars of same temperature, but different luminosity. And what this means is that these are very, very extended supergiant stars, and this is actually a main sequence star, and this is actually a white dwarf. So what's happening here is the pressure in the atmosphere is increasing as you go down the sequence, and you can see that the spectral lines are getting broader and broader and broader, and that's just pressure broadening that you see over here. But what these Los Alamos theorists worked out was that the red wing of Lyman Alpha, remember this is at 4860 angstroms. Lyman Alpha is at 1216 angstroms down over here, right? Past Ingrid over here somewhere. But what they worked out was that the red wing of Lyman Alpha actually is important enough, comes right through the spectrum and causes an opacity source, and that wasn't in the original models. And if you include that, you get not a perfect, but a better fit to the data over here. And it makes the cluster a couple of, about 0.7 gigayears older. So here's the last slide. So, and again, this doesn't come out. Oh dear. This is the most important slide. Okay, I will describe it to you, or you can come and look at my computer. This is a plot of redshift on the y-axis versus age along the x-axis. And this is Mark Halperin's crowd. This is their best model for, this is the WMAP model for the universe. And that's what the solid line is over here. So this is with their best model, H naught of 70 some odd, H of 13 gigayears and so on. So this tells you what the redshift is at any particular age. And plotted on here is the age, our best age for this cluster, which turns out to be a little over 12 gigayears, which is sitting over here, and that means that if you take a look at Mark's and their group's model, it turns out to be a redshift of around 4. So what this means is that this cluster formed at a redshift of around 4, 12 gigayears, which is would be a redshift of 4 in their model. Over here is the star formation history of the universe. This is a thing called the Madow plot, and this basically tells you the number of stars, the amount of solar masses formed per unit volume as a function of redshift in the universe. And the numbers are here are 0, 2, 4 is over here, 6 is over here. And our cluster sits right over here at a redshift of around 4. And this is important because there are papers in the literature where people have talked about globular star clusters being responsible for the reionization of the universe. And that comes out at you know, 6 and beyond. I think the best WMAP number was 15-ish, but it still looks as though reionization took a long time, probably from a redshift of 15 down to a redshift of 6, anyways. So our globular cluster is sitting just about over here, well before, or well after reionization, and I think it's very hard to believe that it was involved, has anything to do with reionization of the universe. But it's also of interest to note that they formed well before the peak in the star formation history of the universe. So I'm done. I just hope that you get some feeling for the range of rather interesting physics that one can do with these mundane little stars that are the size of the Earth, but rather hot.
Scott, you went to such lengths to tell me how you analyze the data, I have to ask the one part you skipped. How do you tell the galaxies from the stars?
Okay, so what I get to talk about here is we have shape parameters also. Okay, so we have morphology parameters, sharpness. If things are too spiky, they're cosmic rays. If things are too extended, we throw them out because they're galaxies. But that only works down to a particular level. Because then they're, you know, at some point you can't, at some signal to noise, you can't tell a star from a galaxy. So proper motions are the thing that do it for you, right? But you can see that a lot of this stuff that we did, particularly the age, we don't use the proper motion corrected diagram because it doesn't go as faint, because the first epoch was sort of, the first epochs were sort of crummy because the camera wasn't as good and they're not very long exposures. So what we had to do with the white dwarf discussion was to simply model what we thought the number of galaxies were by looking away from the white dwarf sequence and modeling those numbers. And that's probably pretty good. But the best way is certainly proper motions. We did have another epoch with the same camera scheduled for last season with Hubble, but the camera failed just before we were supposed to take those data. We do have an application in for this round of Hubble. Hopefully we'll get the time to do that. And then we'll be able to proper motion clean to the limit of the data, which will solve all the galaxy problems, and also tell us if there's a, if there is a trickle of white dwarfs off the end of this truncation, because that's the originally hot, very high mass stars in the cluster, and those are really interesting. And we can't tell because there's too many galaxies there. It would be very nice if there was a big black cloud behind this cluster, you know, so the rest of the universe wasn't visible through it, but
Was Russell at H, I don't know who that was, were they left-handed? Is that why you decided to plot increasing temperature going to the latitude? I mean, I don't understand why they would have done that.
I don't know if they were left-handed or not. I don't know.
But is there a reason for the clock to go in the direction that it does?
Just historically, they go first.
Yeah, the color.
The original was color magnitude diagram.
Right.
The color becomes positive.
One of the units and the rhetoric was more positive coloring.
Oh, okay.
So that was the original thing.
Yeah, Jason, that's right.
So
the color's more negative, it's to the left, and you increase it to the right.
Okay.
Good. Thanks, Jason.
Okay, that figure's the age was 12.2 gigayears. That's effectively the age from the cooling of the white dwarf.
No. That's the age when we actually include the main sequence lifetime.
All right. Now, what mass were you assuming for the initial mass of the star that gave you the oldest?
We don't have to assume it. We know what the mass of the precursor was because we use an initial final mass relationship. Okay. So the argument is this: we have this particular white dwarf. We know its mass. We use an initial final mass relationship, which we're actually have data on. That gives us the mass of the main sequence star, which is the precursor of that. And then we use some of these models to get
Did you include in the errors indication? Did you include the uncertainties in the initial final mass?
Yes, that's definitely in the model, for sure. That's a real point of uncertainty in this. What seems to be worse is that this was a real surprise for us. I mean, when we published this first, when we published this last year, we put an error and we very clearly say that this was, this didn't involve systematic errors using different models. And then the people came up with this line of minimal opacity. And that made a huge difference, way bigger, that's bigger than our statistical error. The difference is bigger than our statistical error. So that was a bit of a shock, but
the oldest star, what do you know? Do you know exactly what mass you found in the initial mass?
For the oldest ones we can see, it's not very high.
About two
and a bit solar masses. We're not seeing 4, 5, 6 solar masses.
Okay.
But remember, there are going to be very few if mass function.
That's what I was worried about. To what extent did you see stopping. There are many fewer high mass stars in a lot of the
sure.
than there were
sure.
mass stars, and could that just be the fact that you're not?
Sure. So that truncation can be due to the fact that there weren't very many high mass stars in the cluster, or the high mass stars make high mass white dwarfs, and they evolve very quickly. So there could be a big trail of, but not very many, out to.
More questions?
From your age estimate of the cluster, are you suggesting any inferences as to whether the globular cluster was originally formed as part of the galaxy or wandered in later?
I don't think I can say anything about that directly, Doug. I don't think I can say anything directly about that. It could have been captured. I mean, that's the way galaxies form. I mean, little bits come together to make bigger bits. And the fact is, there are some ideas that maybe the globular clusters, were a very early stage in all of this, and then they came together to help form the larger galaxy. So everything is accreted from something else. I mean, it's a whole hierarchical scheme.
Is the rate of white dwarf formation well known? And the reason I ask is if that is well known, shouldn't you be able to tell the difference between the neutrino cooling and the non-neutrino cooling just by looking at the density of white dwarf?
Yes, that's what I was trying to do here. But the problem is the statistics are horrid, right? We have one star that's still undergoing intensive neutrino cooling.
So the switch between neutrino being significant and not is so sharp.
It's huge. I mean, it's big. You can see that the neutrino luminosity dominates by factors of several when it's hot. So you need, I mean, this is a very nice project to do. This is a single field, so we don't have very many hot white dwarfs. For example, you could do lots of relatively short exposures. Say, you probably don't even need Hubble for the cluster to get lots of very hot white dwarfs.
But even if it isn't the dominant cooling mechanism, even if it's significant or contributing at all in a non-negligible way, right? You don't have to look at just the white dwarfs where it's the most significant.
No. So you can look farther down the sequence and say, your model predicts that the cooling time here is 2 gigayears, for example, and then you can play the game that way. But that's not going to generate the neutrino. That'll tell you about white dwarf formation, but it's not going to tell you anything about neutrinos. I mean, I could have taken, how many white dwarfs do I have down to 2 gigayears, right? And then I could have done the statistics that way. That would be fine. It would tell me about a birth rate, more statistically more valid, but it wouldn't tell me anything about neutrinos.
Okay, one last question, Bill.
This is just something that confused me about the resolution here. You talked about, the resolution of Hubble was what, about a tenth of an arc second, I thought.
Well, the pixel.
You're talking about motions of milli arc seconds.
We can centroid to about a hundredth of a pixel for a bright star. The pixel with this particular camera is 50 milli arc seconds. So we can centroid a half a milliarcsecond with decent signal to noise.
So this thing, this peak is 100 times wider than you're measuring the center to?
The centroid is 1/100 of your PSF.
No, we can measure it to 1/100 of a PSF, to 1/100 of a pixel. I'm not saying it is 1/100 of a
right, pixel. But the resolution of the Hubble, is, I thought, was about 1/10 of an arcsecond.
The
full width half maximum.
The pixel with this camera is 0.05 arcseconds, and full width half max is just under 2 pixels. So it's about right. So it's about 1/10 of an arcsecond is full width half max of the PSF. And we can centroid to about 1/100 of a pixel signal to noise problem.
That's when it's spread over 10 pixels or something.
Well, it doesn't quite get spread over 10 pixels. Well, it does it very well.
All right, I think we should thank Harvey for a very interesting talk.
Models for neutrino cooling depend on, well, it has to be a two-body interaction, so you're saying neutrino plus plasma, not neutrino plus individual charge type.
No, neutrino plus plasma.
What do people recommend?